Ryan Dawson for ANC, the Anti-Neocon Report. And with me is a man I've read for a long time. You can see him on UN's Review and many other places of Vineyard. He goes by the nickname The Saker. This is Andre Rajewski. And we're going to be going over an article that he wrote in many places. I've seen it from UN's called Is Putin Really Ready to Ditch Iran? But before we get into that topic, I have another myth that we want to bust about the so-called sale of S-300s. That never happened, and Israel taking a victory dance and a victory lap. And you can see their propaganda, even in papers like Haaretz, which is usually one of the better Israeli papers, falling for this. So we'll be digging through the Hasbara tonight with the Saker. How are you? Welcome to the show. And let's get into this. You doing good?
Yes, Ryan. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. Now, before we tackle this article you wrote, which I would have written this myself if I could have. I don't think it would have been as well done, but I found that you had already done it, so I could just pass that around. But I want to tackle something that happened earlier where Israel Netanyahu, who is under criminal investigation, acts like it was a victory for him, as if he caused Russia to not sell S-300s to Syria. But that's not really what Syria needs or wants to spend their money on, and there never was a sale that ever got blocked, but that's how they presented it. But what was your take on that?
Well, there's a couple of levels here that mixed. First of all, I don't believe Syria actually needs those S-300s, at least not primarily. The biggest threat for Syria right now are cruise missile attacks, as they have happened in the past. And for that, they do already have the system. That's the Panzer S-1 and S-2. That were given to them by Russia, which is a combined missile and gun system, which actually, if you look at the way the Russians use it, if you look at the deployment of air defenses around the Khmeimim air base, the Russians do have S-3 and S-400s, that's true, but they are protected by Panzers. And the reason for that is that S-300s are primarily long-range, high-altitude, high-value targets systems. That is typically AWACS would be the kind of stuff that they would be engaging. That is not primarily the threat for the Syrians. What they are most threatened by is air-to-ground guided munitions and cruise missiles, and they already have that. Now, it is true that there were rumors going back and forth, and there was a lot of pressure put on Russia not to provide the Syrians with S-300s. And after the latest U.S. attack, the Russians said that now we feel free, where we don't consider ourselves bound anymore by the commitment that we made to not to provide that. Now, that's not the same thing. If I'm not bound by something, doesn't mean I have to do it. But it was interpreted that way. I think that was probably not the best choice of language by the Russians, but it's most definitely not that the Israelis, you know, could veto that. Of course, Netanyahu went to Moscow. We saw him on standing with a St. George ribbon. There is definitely a powerful pro-Israeli lobby in Russia, and Netanyahu definitely wanted to some kind of deal going with the Russians. But I think this entire S-300 issue is basically a non-issue, because the Russian air defenses are now integrated with the Syrian ones. So in terms of radar capabilities, the Russian S-400, S-300s, and AWACS aircraft, A-50s, are already networked with each other and, according to statements by Russians and Syrians, with the Syrians. That's one of the things that could explain why so many cruise missiles were shut down, because the Syrians had early warning, much longer range than the actual radar, the search and track radar that you would have on the Panzers that they used. So in terms of radar, of having a good awareness of what's happening, they already have it. So actually, I would say that delivering the S-300s and letting them, you know, defend Syrian positions would probably not be the best system. And yes, it would be highly destabilizing, because the Israelis, their aircraft could be engaged over Lebanon and Israel, which is something Russia doesn't want to have an open conflict with Israel. That's absolutely clear. Those who would expect Russia to actually start a war with Israel are just not being realistic. Russia has no interest to do that. So I think there's a perception thing and then there's a reality thing. And I don't think that S-300 issue is such a big deal, actually, as was made. And certainly not a big victory for Netanyahu.
Yeah, and the evidence is on the ground, too. It was the Panzers that shot down the majority of the cruise missiles. I don't think the S-200 that they did have really got any of them, maybe a couple. So,
if I remember correctly, no. It was mostly the Panzers and shorter range systems, yes.
Yeah, the Buchan one, I got some of them. So if they're going to put their money behind something, it would be more of that anyway. So,
correct.
I wanted that out of the way before we move on to the, you know, this month, Russia has negotiated a deal with Israel. And the way I saw it was essentially like this. You've got two, maybe two and a half pockets of ISIS, Al-Qaeda left in Syria. There's one up in Idlib, one in Daraa, and then Deir Ezzor has a small little slither with, you know, some hiding into the desert and stuff too. But the Daraa mission is, well, it's already happened. It started yesterday. But the negotiation was if we get Iranian troops out, which they don't really need, or well, they don't call them troops, advisors, but it's Iranian militias, let's be for real here, then Israel will not going to intervene on the attack on Daraa, because they have been. Every time they get close to the Israeli border, Israel carries out strikes on so-called Iranian targets, and they wanted to knock that off and hopefully negotiate that the U.S. would leave Al-Tanf if Iran left the south, so would the U.S. State Department disagreed, but it's happened anyway. The assault on Daraa is already ongoing, and Israel hasn't lifted a finger so far. But prior to all this, people were losing their minds saying, why is Russia even talking to Israel? I mean, anything short of bombing Tel Aviv, is you're just a Zionist puppet and in their pocket or what have you. But they're not really ditching Iran, and they're definitely not in the pocket of Israel. And your article goes over these 10 points of what Israel's initial goals were. And then you're looking at it, and they really didn't get any of them. So it's hard for them to do a victory dance now. Would you like to go over some of the points or motivations of what Israel is trying to do in Syria? Because I agree, this is an Israeli-backed proxy force. And how much of that have they gotten accomplished?
Okay, sure. Well, first of all, they wanted to replace a secular Ba'athist, a state reasonably tolerant of minorities, pretty well-organized political system, a pretty robust army. They wanted to replace that by takfiris of the Daesh al-Qaeda type for a number of reasons. First of all, it would, of course, tremendously weaken Syria itself. Secondly, they also knew, and remember, it's when thinking about the Middle East, I always have this mantra, it's all about Iran. It's always about Iran. They wanted to unleash the Daesh types against Hezbollah, which is not an Iranian proxy or an Iranian militia, but it's an ally of Iran. That's true. And they were the ones who inflicted a tremendous defeat upon the combined force of the IDF in 2006. And since then, it's a problem for the Israelis. I mean, when they had the war there, they couldn't even hold Bin Jbeil, which is, you know, couple of miles off the Israeli border, 33-day-long war. They couldn't even get that done against them. And mind you, the type of Hezbollah forces that fought in southern Lebanon, probably between 1,000 to maybe 1,500 soldiers, were not even the elite units. They were a mix of professionals and militiamen. Hezbollah kept the best north of the Litani River. So just imagine how humiliating that defeat was for Israel. So their idea was to actually unleash the Al-Qaeda types against Hezbollah. And there was a beginning of that in Lebanon. There were actually some combats even inside Lebanon, but Hezbollah took care of that and then took the decision to assist the Syrians. So that plan completely failed. But the concept was to, you know, to have Muslims fight each other, and then arguing that there's chaos in Lebanon and horrible, gruesome terrorist movements, then to create a further security zone, justifying that they're threatened by them.
Yeah, even in their policy papers about Syria, they said they want the desired goal is to get sectarian infighting, as had been done in Lebanon, because Lebanon had a massive and very long civil war of that type. But they've learned from their mistakes, and it's just not happening again.
Yeah. So then they fell back on the concept of maybe breaking up the country with this entire Kurdistan concept, which they tried both in Iraq and in Syria, and that didn't work well at all. So basically all, and the big goal, of course, is to create the environment to eventually get the Americans to attack Iran, which is the end objective. None of that really happened. I mean, they lost the war on the ground in Syria. And now my concern is that I think the Israelis are pushing the neocons in the United States and the Trump administration to now attempt kind of a reconquista by trying to at least break up the country. You're absolutely correct about the idea that the kind of deal made by between the Israelis and the Russians is, okay, fine, we will move the pro-Israeli militias away from the border, but you don't intervene for having Syrian troops, retaking control of the border. Well, the Israelis are not directly intervening, but the State Department is saying that if that happens, we're going to intervene. So I think, frankly, they're all trying to cheat each other. And either way, the Israelis and the Americans are not trustworthy partners with whom you can make a deal. And I don't think Putin is naive either. He understands who he's dealing with. The last thing I would say about him that he's naive. But he's engaging in a risky strategy because, unfortunately, every time the Russians try to negotiate something, it is immediately interpreted by the Zionists and the propaganda machine as a weakness, a surrender, or betrayal.
Because that's how
and then, of course, invites more escalation. Yes, exactly. Oh, yes, it's absolutely. It's projecting their own attitude. And that invites
that,
further
that is what
escalation.
They do on everything. Everything they do is projection. Oh, you're going to wipe us off the map. They are actually wiping Palestine off the map. Oh, we think you're building a nuclear bomb. They actually secretly built nuclear weapons. Like, everything they accuse everyone else of, they're guilty of doing themselves. And they can't sort of see past their own personality type. They think everybody thinks and behaves like them. Like, oh, what's the backroom deal here? How can you be honest? Because they aren't.
Yes, and add to that an absolute sense of you know, racial superiority. We're the smartest. We're going to win no matter what. Let us just double down over and over again.
I think one
it's
of
a very dangerous situation.
One of their politicians just openly said that Jews are the smartest and the most supreme race. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yet the average IQ of Israel is about 90. But anyway.
Oh, I didn't know that. But they would probably blame it on the 20% Palestinians then. Don't worry.
Well, Palestine's is higher. So they have a higher literacy rate than the United States. But whatever. One interesting part about this Dara attack, the State Department did say that. I think that was a face-saving maneuver because they had four negotiations in two of the areas that had already been liquidated by the Syrian army because it's kind of like it was a stupid red line to make because America can't get boots on the ground because Congress won't allow it and the American public doesn't want it. And their subsonic cruise missiles are too slow to really do any damage because they're going to get blocked. And then the Air Force, they could flatten them, but they would have to take a lot of casualties and they're not willing to stomach that. So it's a hollow threat. They can't really do anything other than continue to secretly aid Al-Qaeda forces, and they're having a hard time continuing that practice. So I think they were
not
just
so
saying,
sure
you
about
can't
that
come
because
in
well, the thing is that I agree that the subsonic cruise missiles are, you know, not ideal, but the thing is they have a lot of them, and my big concern is simply a matter of quantity. I think I hope that the Russians are supplying Panzers at an industrial rate right now because it's just a matter of raw numbers at that point. Even if every one of your missiles shoots one down, if I have, 50 times more than you have, you're going to run out of missiles.
That's true. Last time they had 300 left that they didn't fire, and they also spread it over 10 targets. If they were to pile all that up on one target, they definitely would have gotten through.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, there is an absolute threat of the neocons going ballistic and deciding, as Bolton wanted, to hit not only the Syrians but actually hit Russians, which at that case would result in a war.
That's
so. I think the situation is still very, very dangerous. I mean, I'm very concerned about what's happening there.
Just Bolton being back in power is nuts already, but. I didn't even know that guy was still alive. Like, where did you dig him up? I mean, in the ranking of neocons, he's like at least number 6. And that's really bad, like from the top. Like, he's not like Richard Pearl level or anything, but he's up there for sure. The Israelis just did a secret airstrike near El Bukma, or South Deir Ezzor. And I saw a lot of reporting blaming that on the United States at first. But even the United States has said the Israelis did that. Now, from my sources, they're saying that this group, the reporting was that it was Syrian, but they weren't Syrian. They're a bunch of Shia Iraqis, kind of a Iranian-led. And do you think Israel is trying to provoke Iran into doing something stupid, like some sort of retaliation. Of course, the news media would start the story from when Iran reacted, not saying anything about what Israel did first, or all year long, really. Because then that would be caucus belli for the U.S. to hit Iran. Because it doesn't seem like they have a way of winning in Syria. All they can do is stall. But they do. They've been gunning for Iran since at least 2007. And do you think that was part of the motivation for why Israel keeps striking Iranian targets in Syria? Or because they're not protecting their border when they're hitting them way out in the east?
I think you're spot on two things. First of all, you mentioned the boot on ground issue. If you look at what I call the axis of kindness, which is the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia, they're very similar. None of them can really commit boots to the ground, and if they did, they would fail. And that is their biggest weakness. That's why even if, and we've seen that, even if there was a massive attack on Syria, what we would have is, you know, Lebanon 2006 repeated at a much bigger scale, but the outcome is the same. You cannot control a country with cruise missile attacks. It's just not going to happen. You need boots on the ground, and they don't have that. So you're absolutely correct. They would love to take on Iran directly and have a pretext. I don't think the Israelis have the means or the guts to take on Iran by themselves. It's a much tougher target than any other ones in the region. It's a much more powerful country. But yes, of course, they're trying to provoke them. I think you're spot on. That's the key thing, to provoke them as much as possible, to try to get some retaliation out of them, and then have a pretext to then quote unquote retaliate, which of course would be, you know, counter retaliation, or if you want, escalate your attack. And if then eventually Iran is hit directly and Israel then is hit in return by Iran, they would say, well, look at that, they're trying to wipe us off the map, and then get the Americans to fight the war on their behalf. I mean, that's the end goal of the Israelis, is to get the USA to attack Iran on their behalf. And that's what's so dangerous, because they're acting recklessly towards that.
I always wonder who is worse. Do the Israelis demonize Iran more, or does the U.S. demonize Russia more? Because anything bad that happens in the world, CNN and the rest of the alphabet soup are like, the Russians did it. And I say, if a tree falls in the woods and no one sees it and no one hears it, mm-hmm. will Israel still blame Iran?
Yeah, they probably will. You know, and if needed be, they're going to bring up the 6 million issue, the Holocaust. I mean, whatever. They're going to press all the right buttons. And since, sadly enough, the Trump administration has completely caved into the neocons, I mean, they run the show. Mm-hmm. My last, you know, semi-hope is what I think happened is that there are people in the United States military who are deliberately trying to prevent that. I mean, frankly, that last American attack was very limited in scope. It's not what Bolton wanted. So somebody did the right thing there and said, you know, we're not going to enter a war with Iran or Russia for that matter, because I don't think the U.S. could win a war against Iran. I think the U.S. could devastate Iran, but not win. It's a big difference. And the same way Israel devastated Lebanon in 2006, they did.
They can't do it without public support, and they just don't have it. It's really odd or funny, and I mean funny and mean like strange, not ha-ha funny, but that George Bush Sr., after the first Gulf War, said, we've kicked Vietnam syndrome, meaning, you know, reluctance to put boots on the ground and everything. But then Gulf War II re-emerged Vietnam syndrome. It's now the Iraq syndrome. Because after that war was so stupid and pointless, and so many people died, that now Americans are war weary again. So from going to war in Iraq, they kicked Vietnam syndrome, and then going to war in Iraq again, they reinstated it. But you're absolutely right. When Israel lost, they only lost like 108 soldiers, something like that, in 2006. But the oy veying in the streets reached fever pitch because they have mandatory service. Which is good in the sense that if they didn't have it, they probably wouldn't have. They could only coerce some Druze to be in the army, because nobody wants to be there. But the downside is your kid can die too, and so the public thinks, oh, my little Moshe or whatever could die. So they don't want to have boots on the ground, but they'll blow the hell out of Palestinians who are throwing pieces of clay and
exactly.
But they're not going to fight someone that actually has a gun. Or can, you know, has any 1% chance of hitting back. I mean, there's the bully culture.
Yes.
And the United States is tired of it. They're like, why are we spending $6 trillion to go blow the piss out of third world countries and stuff? Like, for what? We didn't get anything out of it. They were thinking at first, Is gasoline going to get cheaper? No, because we didn't go to war for oil, went to war for Israel. But the left has completely missed the boat on that. It's all oil this and that. Like, we bought the same amount before and after the Gulf War. And we already had an oil for food program. And Syria doesn't really have any oil. It's insignificant. We're there for Israel. But that's this narrative that's really hard to spell out to people, how much influence AIPAC and other Zionist lobbies have over the United States. But no one has enough influence to get boots on the ground. They can't even do that inside their own country.
I completely agree with you. That is exactly where the problem is. The real problem is inside the U.S., and the outcome will be decided here. Because Israel by itself would not be that much of an issue. And they know that, and that's why they are putting such efforts into having, you know, the U.S. do their bidding and this entire alliance. And then, of course, don't forget the Saudis, who have their own problems with Iran, serious problems. They hate them and they fear them, and they should. You know, they're all getting together against the one common enemy which they fear most.
Mm-hmm. Do you think some of the mercenary forces from Sudan and Eritrea, etc., that are being sent into Yemen have actually detracted from warm bodies that could have gone to Syria?
I don't know. I have not been following Yemen close enough to make a judgment on that.
Well, the UAE, for example, they only lost like 11 guys, but that was enough. Because actually, I would throw them in the boat with Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the U.S. They don't want to have any skin in the game. So they lost like 11 or 17, like a helicopter got shot down and something else. And after that, they said, all right, we're not using our own soldiers anymore. We're strictly mercenaries from Sudan, even like Colombia. They were getting them from anywhere, you know. This hodgepodge of fighters. But the Islamic ones they'd been sending to Syria. And I'm wondering if the others are just straight mercenaries doing it for money. But I was wondering if some of that had not had to be diverted, because they're losing in Yemen pretty bad right now, which is pathetic, because you've got the wealthiest nation in the Middle East versus, I think, Yemen's the poorest or one of the poorest. And they're beating them. And they're beating them with low-tech, like, bazookas that they just eyeball and aim and... It's amazing that these fighters are tough down there, but I don't know how, if you're not paying that much attention to Yemen, but that seemed like something that maybe had been happening down there. But that's part of the anti-Iran axis too, because Israel and the U.S. all painted as like, oh, it's all completely Iranian-backed forces. I'm like, I don't think so. I mean, Iran is supporting Yemen, but Saudi Arabia and Yemen have been fighting each other since the 60s, and this is the Houthis. This is a real, you know, Yemeni rebellion, yep. You know, fighters. So
it's a warrior culture, but it is an Islamic imperative to resist against oppression. So the Iranians have never denied that they think that they ought to help all the oppressed people, particularly fellow Muslims. So that's why Iran is hated so much, is because anywhere the empire is trying to, you know, lay down its law and force people to comply, as soon as there is a resistance movement appearing, the Iranians are offering their backing, and they're not shy about it. They're not denying it. They say it absolutely. It's a religious obligation of ours, or we will not desist from it.
Well, it's smart, exactly, because if Iran had not helped Hezbollah, etc., then, you know, it might be your neighbors one day, but you're going to be next. So go ahead and move the front line all the way out to where it is and support them right now. And that seems
that's
to be
partially why the Russians, Putin very clearly explained when he started, which is actually a very limited military intervention, but a very crucial one. He explained to the Russian people there are thousands of people from the former Soviet Union, from the Caucasus, and even from Russia, who are, he clearly said it many times, we're better off fighting them there than here. That's why we're fighting there.
And yeah, you don't want a Sunni corridor connecting with Chechnya.
Exactly.
I mean, that's bad enough as it is, and that's very much JSOC and CIA funded the Chechen rebellion, but not completely. But they don't want that connection. And Putin also said, essentially, we're in Syria because we don't want another Libya.
Yeah.
I mean, Libya, they have open air slave markets in Libya now. They handed the country over to Al Qaeda. Yep. And a lot of these refugees that are pouring out of Northern Africa are able to do so because Gaddafi's no longer there to prevent it.
Yeah, and he warned Europe about that. He clearly said, you know, I'm the one who's keeping, you know, the disaster from happening. And, of course, nobody listened.
Well, that was Hillary Clinton's war. But a lot of these Europeans that are angry about let's call them migrants because they're not all refugees. Some are refugees, some aren't. But they don't seem to connect their foreign policy to the migration. Like, if you hadn't blown up Libya and started, you know, supported Al-Qaeda in Syria, then maybe there wouldn't be so many migrants and refugees. But they always start the story in the middle, like, we're completely innocent and these people just showed up.
Yeah, then God forbid you investigate under what influence the French decided to join in so eagerly the attack against Libya. If you look who's involved, it's the French equivalent of AIPAC. And if you start, saying that, then you're branded as a racist. So you can't even discuss the origins of that attack. It's literally the same.
Yeah, well, speaking of 6 million, they always seem to brand whoever they hate as the new Hitler. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, of course.
Ahmadinejad's a Hitler. Saddam's a Hitler.
Putin.
Putin's a Hitler, yeah. Putin is a Hitler. How strange is that? Like, they defeated Germany.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. It's all the same stuff, and I just wonder how long people will continue taking that seriously, and when. I think gradually people, I think there's an improvement. I think, I sense that this, at least the topic can be discussed, and there are more people like you, for example, and others who are, maybe not a multi-billion dollar media holding, but collectively, together, we're making a difference because
I'm a multi-billionaire in Zimbabwe dollars.
Exactly. Okay, so you're a multi-billionaire, and your holding contributes to to asking the right questions. That's very important.
It's I always tell people the reason the truth can win over deception is because it doesn't cost that much to tell the truth. It takes an enormous amount of money to have daily propaganda to maintain a lie. You have to constantly lie over and over again, or people figure it out. It has to be reinforced again and again. Whereas the truth is reinforced by its own reasoning and reality, and you say it and you're done, right? So that's why I say, whether it's UNS or ANC report or antiwar.com or whatever, you with a few thousand dollars you can beat millions of dollars because you're not lying.
Yes, absolutely. And the second thing is that I also believe that changes in history and society usually happens by small groups. It's rarely, a massive 80% popular uprising or anything. The small groups are precisely composed of those who are sharp, smart, and ask themselves the questions and look for their own sources. So maybe, we don't have the numbers, but I think we do have a lot of good people.
I think our numbers are bigger than it appears. I think there's a lot of lurkers out there. But it's like, how, unless they take the time to sit there and write you an email or whatever, you don't really know. Because you can't go off like view counts on any of these social media sites, the popular ones, the YouTube, Facebook, etc., because they lie. I mean, I can create a brand new channel and get 3,000 views on a video, and I can have one with 40,000 subscribers and do the same thing because they hit the handbrake on there.
Yep.
So that's, but the fact that I will meet people in Japan, which is 99.9% don't even speak English, who will come up to me and know who I am and everything, and are listening to it. And when I go to the U.S., I have people ask me, are you Ryan Dawson? It's got to be larger than what they're saying.
Absolutely. I agree with you completely.
I mean, we knew each other. I've known you for a long time.
Of course.
Yeah. And it's not the circles are not as small as it looks like, I think. I think we're winning. And it's, even some mainstream pundits are starting to dip their toe in the water. Tucker Carlson and stuff. So he said, wait a minute, how do we know this gas attack is legit? Did they lie about the last five in a row? They like lying about gas. But they had the white helmets. Is this a propaganda outfit? And that leads to another question. The white helmets, they had their funding cut, right? Trump cuts it. And he's totally neocon, but he's also a New Yorker that lived through 9/11 and hates Al-Qaeda in his version of the events. So he doesn't want to aid Al-Qaeda. But he does want to capitulate to everything Israel demands. Israel can't say Al-Qaeda's on our side. That's not going to fly. So we cut funding to the white helmets, and then it's only, a month and a half later, and it's already back again? And what's going on there?
Well, the U.S. foreign policy has been completely chaotic and inconsistent even before Trump. I mean, under Obama, you had that feeling that every agency, is doing its own thing and not coordinating. So I think we had an exceptionally weak president with Obama. Mm-hmm. And I think Trump is an exceptionally embattled one. And in both cases, you don't have a unitary, you know, efficiently working administration. And that can explain the kind of zigzags. And you add to that a Congress who has now gone absolutely ballistic and wants to basically run foreign policy and prevent the administration from doing what it should be doing by the Constitution. And you have basically an empire that's cracking. So the other good news, I think, is, yes, first of all, we are much more numerous and our reach is way bigger than what the numbers say. And secondly, besides us winning, they, the other guys, I think are losing just on their own by sheer arrogance, hubris, incompetence, infighting, pettiness. All that stuff makes you for very poor, you know, long-term combatant.
They can't work together either. They're all egomaniacal. They definitely lost the great meme war of 2016. Do you pay attention much to Korea? Because I think it's a great example of what we're saying. They, the media, and I mean with three parentheses there, they, when Trump canceled the meeting, you know, there he's going to have this meeting with Kim Jong-un, and then he cancels it like a week out or something. They went nuts saying, "How dare you? You had a chance for peace with Korea and South Korea and China worked so hard, and now you cancel the meeting and you just want to have, you know, you starve him and blah, blah, blah." Then he has the meeting and makes a deal. And how dare you talk to a dictator and make a peace deal? So it's like, yeah, damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Absolutely. That's what they do to Trump. That's what they do to Russia. It's all the same thing. It's whatever you do, you're going to get, you know, blasted and defamed for being, you know, whatever they want to come up with. It's absolutely true.
Don't you think they overplayed their hand with Russia? I mean, with the Skripal thing and Litvinenko and just...
You know what? I'll tell you what, kind of the opposite. They actually got away with it. It's
really
just the same thing as saying that, yeah, look, the Europeans, they all showed solidarity and they all said, you know, highly likely was good enough for them to fall in line. They got away with it. They're still insisting on MH17. The key thing, really, if we want to go to the roots, is this. The guys who did 9/11 were never caught. And their reason for, and that means that they're going to do more and more and more of it. They got away with 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
They got away before that with Gladio. They got away with every time they got away because basically they control the media.
But they screwed up a little bit with Iran-Contra, but then there weren't any real consequences for any of the real players.
True, and the neocons were nowhere nearly as powerful as they are now. The media was much more diverse in those years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had much more also, I think, critical attitude towards the government, et cetera. Now, I mean, after 9/11, that flag-waving patriotism, that support our troops, this entire message of terrifying people, you know, the Muslims are going to come to your village and kill you all and all that stuff. It is a very nasty, I'm quoting a song by David Grovitz here that I like a lot. The media, I think, right now is much, much more toxic than the Soviet media was in the Cold War. I mean, I used to read the Pravda, Izvestia, and others, you know, professionally. And I found them more interesting, more diverse, and more honest than the corporate media nowadays. It's just really that bad.
I always thought it got worse, and I didn't know if it, I mean, because I was so young in the 80s, so I wasn't sure if, well, I was just a kid and wasn't aware of it as much, or if it's, you know, just the advent of the internet, let me know more. But to me, it just seemed like, no, they really did challenge them more back then. And nowadays, it's gotten monopolized more than it ever has before, internet or not.
I think it got worse. I definitely think it got much worse.
Yeah, I'm just going because off American television media.
No, but it's the same in Europe. They're collectively insulting our intelligence by giving us fairy tales, which make absolutely no sense. But, you know, they get away by having that ironclad consensus around it. If everybody says that, there is a very strong psychological pressure to cave in. It's called the Ash conformity experiment. You know, if everybody around you says the sky is red, some people start seeing a red sky.
I call it the lemmings effect.
Do what?
The lemmings.
Lemmings effect, yeah.
Yeah, I did an experiment, a small one. Like, you point up to the sky where there's some stars, whatever, and you say, hey, you see that? You see that red dot? Looks like a satellite or something. You see that red dot? And you have some Confederates be like, oh, yeah, I see it. And then everyone says they see it. And I think, are they lying because they want to be part of the group? Some, but some of them actually, like, make a red dot, like, in their imagination because everyone's saying
it.
That's
true.
It's weird.
Then also the issue of wanting to be the good guys. It's very unpleasant to think that because people associate government with country. It's natural. It's a mistake, but it's natural.
Mm-hmm.
So you love your country, you love your neighbors, you think you're living in a pretty good society, and now you're told by fringe elements that you're actually, all that lifestyle is acquired by imperialism, violence, terrorism, false flag operations. It's torture.
That's why they say and our troops.
It is very...
It's corporate troops, yeah. Not my troops.
Yeah.
Not fighting for me.
Absolutely.
Speaking of 9/11 culprits, as you were saying that, I was thinking in my head, you know, Robert Mueller, they all call Robert Mueller now, he botched the anthrax investigation, like destroyed all the AIM strain of anthrax during the middle of an investigation where they're looking for AIM strain anthrax, right? And prior to that, he refused to look into a dry run of 9/11 where some Saudis were caught. They were trying to enter the cockpit, blah, blah, blah. And it turned out they, so on and so on and so on. And yet he's leading the probe into Trump looking for what? Russia connections, right?
Yeah.
And all he actually found on accident with the Flynn case was an Israeli connection. Because it was Israel that pressured the UN to try and change its vote against
No kidding.
Yeah. So, you know, they're looking for Russia. They find Israel, and nothing happens. It's like, about that. Let's just make a new accusation and say Russia did some other terrible thing. They poisoned these two. This is the dumbest. The Skripal thing was the dumbest story.
They got
some super rare poison only found in Russia. To kill these people who they already had the man in custody for 13 years, but decided to release them and then kill them after that, right? And then didn't even kill him.
I know.
You could just stab him, break his neck, shoot him, anything. But no, let's use this super rare poison instead, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree with you. All of these things are absolutely ludicrous at face value. And yet, thanks to the corporate media... those who question it, do it privately and in a public debate, very little. That's why they're cracking on the social media now. It's next. Because they want to make sure that they have the monopoly in information. That's what's supposed to keep them in power.
The Southern Poverty Law Center a trusted flagger back in March. And immediately my channel, Allison Weir, who does If Americans Knew, a whole bunch of pro-Palestine channels or just telling the truth channels got showed. We all got thrown in the oven. And I got mine back because I got other trusted flaggers to review my videos. And they looked at it and like, there's nothing wrong with this, you know, because there wasn't. And Allison got her channel back too. But I had a month of, you know, not having any videos or, you know, went off the radar like that. Banned on Facebook 6 months in a row. Just got it back and maybe gone today. Who knows? So that's happening. But that I think you get flack when you're over the target. That's why I think they are overplaying their hand. I agree with you that in Europe they're still getting their way because they're getting the policies they wanted. But I don't even think they have to lie. Like they could just do that anyway. Like I don't think they need these false flag gas attacks. They could just attack and be like, screw you, what are you going to do about it? Because none of the people really buy into it anyway, and they still do it. You know what I mean? So I'm at the point where I'm like, why even lie to us? Like, just be the dictatorship you're meant to be and not even have an excuse. Just do it.
But in a way, I would say that if I lie to you and openly oppress you, I it's even more humiliated and more. It requires a higher degree of submission from you if you don't even believe, but you still have to pretend. And that's what they did with Europe with the Skripal thing.
Well, it's like WMDs in Iraq, right? They didn't even plant any. They just said... Oh, they have weapons of mass destruction. We went in, blew everything up. They didn't have weapons of mass destruction. So after the fact, you know that what they said wasn't true. And instead of admitting they lied, they acted like, oh, we're just incompetent and made a bunch of mistakes or something. I'm like, well, that's even just as bad as lying, really.
Yeah, but look, NIST admitted that World Trade 7-7 was in free fall for 2.25 seconds. That's 8 stories, which disappear instantly. That's the official NIST report, which I consider... an admission that it was controlled demolition because no other technology could remove 8 stories from a building instantaneously. Guess what? They got away with that. They admitted it, and they got away with that.
I mean, Israeli crews got caught that were illegally in the World Trade Centers that were working on the fire prevention systems, which did not come on, by the way. And it was less than a few months after 9/11. We even had one of the Al-Qaeda hijacker pilots' first cousins were caught in a spy ring in Lebanon working for the Israeli state. None of that matters, you know, because 9/11 has been like, the 9/11 kook movement, I call it, has been so inundated with weirdos talking about holograms and mini nukes and whatever that normal people who maybe, you know, secretly think, I think there's, you know, maybe this was a jointly conducted covert operation just like Iran Contra. They don't say it because they don't want to be associated with people like Alex Jones and Melonhead, you know, retards like that. That's how they killed 9/11 is just poison the well over and over again to where someone's like, oh, you're one of those people. That's how you kill it with propaganda.
Get your tinfoil hat and you know, go get a padded room. That's what they did. You're correct.
Yeah, they ruined that. But there are people that see through it and are on neither side. They're not on the kook side and they're not on the official story side. And they see what's going on. But it's hard to – it's like every time I bring the topic up, I have to like first prove I'm not one of the Alex Jonesers. and then finally I can talk about the evidence I have and blah, 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 and over it. But – and I got like 100% conversion rate if I can sit someone down and they want to learn about it. But there's no real way to sloganeer it because of all the crazies. So, but they haven't really been effective on Syria, for example. It's just like the White Helmets propaganda. And it's, you know, whether it's Vanessa Beely or Max Blumenthal, whatever, they go out there and just debunk it. And there isn't really a good comeback. They just say, well, Assad gases people. Where's your evidence? Where's your motive? And they don't have any answer. They just keep repeating the lie. And so I'm thinking, man, the public has to see through that. They have to think, like, why are we in Syria? Get out. Because a lot of Trump supporters, they don't want to be in Syria. They just want to build a wall across Mexico. It's not my thing, but that's all they want. Yeah. Like, just build a freaking wall. That's all they care about.
I think a lot of them wanted peace. I mean, if you look at the promises that Trump made, I think a lot of people voted for him because they didn't want war with Russia. They want better relationships. They didn't want, you know, they wanted to get their country back and make America great as opposed to make the empire great. So, and even you tell you what, even with Obama, I mean, I think a lot of people voted for him because, you know, change you can believe in.
Yeah.
And I think the people here in this country, I always try to explain that to Europeans. They're not as nearly as ignorant and stupid as some people think, but they don't have an option. Every time they get an alternative, even under the Democrats.
Right, Obama was like, well, do you want McCain? Hell no. So you have to go with Obama.
Yep.
And then same with Trump. It's like, well, you don't want Hillary Clinton, do you? Well, I got to go with that.
When Rahm Emanuel was running the finances of the Democratic National DNC, he was defunding those Democrats who were against war. So, you know, don't do, what is it, wars of choice or stupid wars. And then they had more wars. Mm-hmm. So every time the American public votes for A, the American public gets B. Every time.
Well, that's the Democrats started World War I, World War II, Vietnam, and Korea. So they're the war party, traditionally. But for people whose history starts in the year 2000 with George Bush, they're like, all the Republicans are the war. Now, we call them neocons for a reason, because conservatives usually didn't act like that. That's why there's a shift, you know. You're but the millennials are unaware of that, some of them.
Yeah, and the Democrats also did Yugoslavia, by the way. So.
Yeah, that's a forgotten war, isn't it? You know,
and that was the first one, because first lady it wasn't from Sweden. In your face, blatant violation of international law, and again, everybody just looked away in shame. But it was an absolute violation of the UN Charter, international law, everything. It was just because we say so, because we can do it. And everything else came after that, you know. And same thing for the false flags. You're kidding me. In Yugoslavia and the Markali market and then, you know, the Racak village in Kosovo, it's all the same thing.
And it's got Libya a big, fat statue of Bill Clinton in Kosovo right across from one of these Wahhabi madrasas, these ISIS factories is what I call them, ISIS factories.
Yeah.
And these people were I think one of the ISIS commanders was from Kosovo, you know, or Serbia, whatever. So they don't see it's not backlash, because backlash is unintended consequences. These are intentional and predictable consequences that they don't care. I think Paul Wolfowitz said, or no, it was Michael Ledeen, maybe he said, every now and then you have to pick up one of these shitty countries and smack it against the wall.
Yeah,
right.
He did.
One of those two said that. I mean, they both would agree with each other on that statement anyway, but...
Yeah,
it's the neocons, and we've got to root them out. And I'm so glad you brought up, I know this circles back to the middle of the conversation, but you said the equivalent of AIPAC in France pushed them into war in Libya.
Yes, they did very strongly. I mean, Bernard Henri Lévy was the main guy who actually went to see the president and told him to start the war. But the entire, hold on, what they're called, I forgot their name now. UEJF is one of them, and then there's a second one, whatever. The equivalent of AIPAC there is fantastically powerful in France. I mean, I would say they're more powerful than AIPAC in the U.S. You know, and they pushed. They pushed for it with everything they had, as actually did the same circles push for the war in Yugoslavia, I would add.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing new happening here again.
And the fall of Libya allowed the transfer of weapons and mercenaries into Syria, which is like the second phase, or really the third phase of that.
Absolutely.
People, you know, all the narrative I get on Libya is, oh, it's the gold dinar. Oh, it's the petrodollar. Oh, and they're just, Israel's missing from the equation once again. And I'm like, they've been talking about the dinar for 30 years, and I don't feel like debunking it, but it was Israel. And it's hard to get that message out and clear, because it's complex, and you have to know about geopolitics and so on. But it just seems a lot easier to just scream, to blame every war on a resource. Just say oil, gold, gas, something like that. But there are some conflicts like that, like in Afghanistan. Opium is definitely a huge motivator for sustaining that conflict. So it's not like never happens, but...
Yeah, I think it's a confluence of different... I always think of it as a mathematical vector. The sum vector is, you know, the sum of different vectors. I don't think Israel is the only consideration by far.
No, it isn't. That's the only one not being spoken of.
In the Skripal case, I always speak of an Anglo-Zionist empire. In the Skripal case, the Anglos, you know, were at the core of it, not so much the Zionist. And then there's the imperialists, you know, who want to maintain the empire at any cost. So the comparison I would make is like mafia families. You know, they might fight each other on occasions, but they're always going to unite against the common people or the cops. And if you look at Iran in terms of terrorism, that's the cop. I mean, they're the ones who do the most, actually, against Wahhabi terrorism in the region. And I would say Russia is another one. They're really trying hard. So if you really want to be anti-terrorist, support Russia and Iran. No, they're supporting Israel and the Saudi Arabia, which is the prime terrorist in the region. It's absurd.
Is that you said something that echoes what Senator Richard Black from Virginia said. He said, state senator, he said... he didn't say mafia families. He said they're like competing cocaine cartels.
Yeah.
Like competing drug cartels will fight with each other over, you know, distribution of their drugs or whatever. But ultimately, they're selling drugs to people, and that's their plan. So they're kind of like that. And that's how al-Nusra and Ar-al al-Sham and a lot of these groups in Syria are. They're like competing drug cartels. They're all against the Syrian people, but now and then they fight with each other over, you know, funding and so on.
And again, the problem on our side is that that message is a complex one. Our adversaries beat us from both sides by offering slogans and very, very simple, crude messages, such as Islam is terrorism.
Assad or the other
must one. There's no such thing as an Islam, or there's no such thing as Islamic terrorism. You know, I mean, and people who, you know, like us, try to actually bring a nuanced argument, we get immediately labeled by both sides and discredited, because any argument that's nuanced, we are, you know, the bad guys and working for the other side.
There's no Islamic terrorism, Islam's a religion of peace, blah, blah, blah. That's the straw man that the other side, that's the kind of opposition they need, because it's really easy to knock down. Like, what are you talking about? Anybody can have terrorists. It doesn't matter. You can be like, well, they're not true Islam. Whatever, dude. You know, all the crusaders and killing, you know, 25% of the Earth's population with genocide of American Indians. Oh, well, they weren't real Christians, you know.
Exactly.
Okay. You know, it's like that's who paid for it. So whatever. But yeah, that's the kind of petty argument they want to get people sucked in and wasting time. They don't want a nuanced voice. And it's the nuanced voices that are getting censored. If you have an extremist opinion, even if it's completely anti-war, if you're one of the extremist types or one of these people that just runs around blaming everything on the Jews or something like that, they love that. They're not going to censor that. They'll let you say that all day long.
you're absolutely correct. I agree with you, and that's the main thing that they use against us is you know, simple sloganeering, and then immediately after that, labeling.
Yeah, you're this and that.
Everything.
You know? Yeah, you're a Hitler or whatever.
Fill the blank.
Yeah,
I've been called a commie, a Nazi, an anti-Semite, Jew lover, Muslim, I mean, you name it, I've been called it.
I've been called a Zionist, which is the most funny. I've been called, I've been called a Nazi. I've been called, or a neo-Nazi, whatever. I get all that. But the most offensive thing I've ever called, someone called me a liberal one time. That was pretty bad. But someone called me a communist. I'm like, what?
I've been called that, and I've been called a liberal. I had the full list. I'm also pro-American and anti-American at the same time. I mean, I kind of keep track if there's something new popping up, but mostly I ignore it.
It's like you can't decide if I'm a Zionist Jew. Some people think, I've also been called a government agent. I've been called a Russian agent just because I was on RT a few times. I guess I'm also an Iranian agent because I'm on Press TV too.
Yeah.
Well, I've been on the Jon Stewart show, so what, I'm now an agent at Comedy Central? Like, what?
Probably.
Whatever. But how do we fight that sloganeering and labeling? Like, I think the labeling kind of runs dry if you just keep doing your thing and people see you and they're like, he's not a fill in the blank. But the sloganeering, sadly, is very powerful. Should we not spend a little bit more time making our own, like, memes and stuff like that? Would that be worthwhile to, you know, to have some people working on that?
I don't think so, at least.
Or is that stupid to their level?
Look, I wouldn't say I'm necessarily opposed to it. It's just not what I do, and it's just not my approach. My approach is to basically ignore it, so never reply on that same level, because slogans are just, they lack an argument. And some people, I noticed that.
George Carlin, right?
In the comment section, Carlin, yeah. In
the comment section, for the symbol-minded.
some people write paragraphs which, if you look at it, are actually just a sequence of slogans. They think in slogans. Uh-huh. So why even debate that kind of level? No, I think we should denounce it, warn about it, and just count on people to with time and make up their own opinion, because I think that's where we'll win. We won't out-stupid them, but we might outsmart them. And it just takes, you're right, it takes more time, but you're also spot on. It's much easier to defend the truth critically than to mindlessly repeat stupid slogans.
We can't help
it. It gives them a short-term advantage, but you can't hold on to it too long. So we just have to be patient and accept that that comes with the territory. That's all. I think we should continue doing exactly what we're doing. Present nuanced, sometimes contradictory arguments. Open them for critical, be critical of everything, and just not imitate them.
There's definitely an audience for it, because if you had told me 15 years ago or something that I had a pretty low opinion of the hoi polloi or whatever, the plebs, the public or whatever you want to say, I thought there's no way people would listen to 1 or 2 hour podcast about geopolitics and like very nuanced, what's this weapon system do and what this person say and what's this policy. No one would listen to politics, like real politics. It's like snore fest for hours and do it, you know, every week or maybe every day. No one would do that. People are too stupid. Well, people are smarter than what was projected, right? They're not as dumb as, you know, as we're treated. We're not as dumb as what we're treated through commercials and stuff. They're aiming at the lowest common denominator, I suppose. But there are a lot of people out there that want to know, hey, what's going on in Yemen? Can you explain the attack on Daraa in Syria? What's going on in Ukraine? What's going on in Korea? What's going on in this? And so, and thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, sometimes hundred thousands want to know what's really going on. And I'm thinking, the reason they're coming to myself or you is because it's not on TV. Right?
Yeah.
You can't get the truth from television, so they are out there looking for it. And you can find it on the web, you know, when it's not censored. So people are smarter than they're given credit for. But I keep losing faith, because there is definitely a very vocal minority that are just unbelievably dumb. That you know, think their world is flat and stuff like that. And I think, wow, is this Idiocracy? Was that not a comedy? Was that supposed to be a horror movie?
I think it's deliberately induced, frankly, when I look at the education system. And I mean, that not only the schools, but the media, et cetera, our rulers deliberately try to stupidify us, to make us into mindless drones who are obedient. So the best thing we can do is actually, those who resist intellectually to that, is to help each other, to help network, to create, you know, as large, I call it a network of networks. And just to try to encourage people to write, to speak up, to take their own initiative. And people do. When you give them an opportunity to do something, you say, you know, if you're interested, why don't you write about that? Very often, for instance, I get an email by somebody who's very, very, you know, upset or really has strong opinion about a topic. I say, you know what? Could you turn that into an article? And I don't even care who that person is. I don't ever ask for resumes. I don't care what the person did in the past. I don't care what they do in their private lives.
No, whatever they wrote is the what output. They wrote. If it's good, it's good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I say, and very often it's surprisingly good. People who, they didn't tell me, I never thought I would be able, you know, I never thought of myself being able to write an article. And the article is actually really good because a person is passionate about something.
Yeah.
And
I mean, anybody that went through school and had English class or whatever their language is, whatever, you've written enough stuff that you can write about. You can write an article. You just have to do some research and know what you're talking about. But you have the skills. It's not a, you don't have to go through journalism skill to write a political opinion or something in a
Absolutely.
Newspaper. Yeah, you don't need and to. I think people are kind of scared and underestimate themselves.
Another huge advantage we have is that, in my opinion, those who actually work on behalf of an interest group, be it financial or political, they're all about money. That's all that interests them. So, and that shows after a while. Whereas in our case, you know, even if we accept donations, this is not our primary, you know, it's not a way for us to make money. We could do it differently. And a lot of people don't even want money.
10 years.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't want money, actually. The people create their own websites and do stuff, and they have very good careers or are retired. They don't need a penny. They do that because they profoundly believe in what they're doing.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of advantages over the opposition. On the long term, I'm optimistic. What frightens me is in the meantime. Now, what's the price going to be for the fall of that empire? That's what keeps me up at night.
They always go down kicking and screaming. Like, they're not going to go down quietly. Yes. Yeah.
I'm afraid so.
Well, I'm in a peaceful nation, and things are getting better on our side of the globe with the peace treaty and stuff. So a little bit of sunshine in the land of the rising sun. And I do think the empire has failed in Syria. I mean, they certainly destabilized Syria for a while and depleted their treasury and a lot of blood. But short of some giant false flag, I cannot see them winning in Syria. Like, they're going to get wiped out of the southwest this summer, and it'll be on to Idlib. They can't win there. They lost. They toppled Iraq. They toppled Libya. They were not able to get it done in Syria. And a lot of it's for what you and I both said in this talk is they can't get skin in the game. They can't get boots on the ground.
Yeah.
And you just can't win with an air campaign and pretty somewhat untrained proxy forces as your boots. It doesn't work like that.
Particularly if you're fighting highly principled people who know what they're fighting for, like the Syrian, you know, the new Syrian military now that's been reorganized and has maligned the Iranians and the Iranian, you know, pro-Iranian militias. These people all fight for profound ethical, religious, and moral reasons. That's why they're much, much, so much superior in terms of, you know, of what they're willing to do.
Oh, they're fighting to save their own families. I mean, that's no better reason
literally.
Than that. Literally fighting to save their own family, their own house against these, you know, Wahhabi nuts that are not even diaspora. They're just like people from everywhere. What I fear, though, is as they see the writing on the wall and everything falling apart, that they might actually allow these Al-Qaeda groups to get man pads that could shoot down Syrian and Russian planes, which would be, they haven't let them do that so far because they could bring those to France or anywhere else and shoot down commercial airliners just as easily. But there are Bolton-type people who are crazy enough to be like, yeah, give it to them. That's my only fear there. I think they've lost in Syria. I'm really proud of the Syrian army and the Russians and everybody everybody that contributed to that because it was close back in, like, ended 2015, 2016.
Very.
And now there's no way. There's no way they're going to get any territory back. It's just the red is growing on the map. Most maps have this SAA in red. And it's not going to be losing any territory whatsoever. Daraa will be liberated by the end of August.
I sure hope so. Let's hope that the Israelis don't manage to get the Americans to blow it all up.
Was there anything else you wanted to add about the relationship between Israel and Russia for those who think that they're secretly allied or whatever? Like, how ridiculous that is, because
no, I would just say that there is a very complex relationship. I even wrote an entire article dedicated to that. It's very multi-layered. Mm-hmm. And it's not certainly not that the Israelis and Putin are working hand in hand together. That's ridiculous. But there is a powerful Zionist lobby in Russia, yes. Definitely.
Sure.
And they also try to lobby on behalf of Israel and of the West generally. There's a pro-Western lobby in Russia, I call them columnists, and they very, very much exist. So Russia, I think the key thing to understand is that, well, I would say two things. First of all, Putin is a very good man who inherited a very bad system. And it's important to realize that systems can be crushing. Look what happened to Trump. And the second thing that I would say is that Russia is still struggling for her sovereignty. It's not a fully sovereign country. And the real threat for Russia historically has always been internal, and it's still true today. Now, things are getting better. There are somewhat zigzags here and there, but don't think of Russia as a unitary actor. In key moments when national security is at risk, yes, Russia is a unitary actor. And we saw that very clearly in the case of Syria, in the case of Georgia, in the case of Crimea, when it was a matter of national security, what I call the Putin people, who come from a national security background, they take the decision, they prime, and the pro-Western element, I personally call them Atlantic integrationists, they usually sort of look away and shut up and wait for a better time to push their economic policy. And, you know, all the talk about a rapprochement with the U.S. or Europe, that's their circles. So there's an unstable balance there. And when a crisis really hits, so far, the national patriotic-oriented people have prevailed. But still, it does not mean that they're not going to be zigzags. I remind you that under Medvedev, for instance, Russia did sanction Iran. Mm-hmm. And did allow a no-fly zone over Libya, which the formulation was very dangerous, said by all necessary means to impose that, which, you know, was then creatively reinterpreted as meaning the right to bomb. So Russia is herself struggling. As soon as people understand that, that's why things are not perfect. So it's naive to say that things are perfect in Russia, because there obviously aren't.
Of course.
But it's also wrong to say that Russia, you know, is in cahoots with the empire and they're all working together, because that's demonstrably false.
Yeah, if they weren't in Syria, they wouldn't have to be making deals in Syria, because Syria wouldn't
exactly.
be there anymore.
That's exactly it. All they needed to do to help Israel is do nothing, sit.
All they had to do is be a dindu, and that the proxy forces would have basically taken everything but maybe Damascus, which would have fallen apart, you know, eventually. And all of them were preaching the slogan, Assad must go, Assad must go. Yep. They really saved them. When they came in and started bombing the caravans of oil that were going to Turkey and acting as a, you know, the backup air force for Syria. Credit the Syrian army, but they were able to get their gear together and push these people out. And I think Russia may be helping with tactics too, because their Syria realized, quit chasing ISIS around, force them all into the same area so you have fewer and fewer fronts. And they
actually reorganized. They actually reorganized several brigades. I mean, the Russian advisor are deeply involved in tactics. You're correct.
Well, I didn't know that. I just said it seemed like that. So if you have knowledge on that, then good. But I was just you know, it seemed like it. It was a reasonable, you know, it wasn't just pure speculation. It was reasonable, but yeah. Well, I would like people to follow you, and I'll have all your links below this podcast, and I appreciate your time. I don't want to hold you over too long. I think I went about 5 minutes over, but
No problem.
All the best, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
There's an uncivil war in Syria, 100,000 dead, millions of refugees without a food, without a roof over their heads, proxy armies flowing into a country open wide. You got Al-Qaeda and America fighting side by side. You got Saudi monarchs and French socialists on one team. You got Russia and Iran backing the regime. You got the Arab League having another meaningless debate, saying let's just see what happens if we wait. But now the West says gloves are off, it's all become too real. Now Cameron and Obama are dictating the deal. Now red lines have been crossed, now it's time to act. Now it's time to have a few million tons of impact. Now it's time to do the thing the West does best. Time to step in the hornet's nest. We don't know who did it, but there's been a war crime, so we'll bomb an Arab country one more time.